Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Thanks for having me here today. I've been on the campus all day, and I do say that it's a real punishment to be inside the buildings. I don't know how you actually go to class here, but it's a lovely campus, and I met with many of your computer science faculty members, and you've got a great faculty here as well. Just a couple things about our fund, so you know what I've been doing for the last 19 years. About 18 years ago, we decided to start a venture fund. And for those of you who, has anybody in the audience raised money from a venture capitalist before? Okay. Does anybody in the audience plan on raising money from a venture capitalist sometime in the next 5 years? Okay, that's most of you. Well, when we raised our first fund, we had 133 meetings to raise $35 million because nobody wanted to fund a venture firm focused exclusively on software. They thought that was just such an outlandish idea. Who would fund companies where the assets walk out the door at night? Isn't that so competitive? Doesn't it become commoditized fast? But since that time, we've raised six funds. Our sixth fund we just closed. We have $1.2 billion under management. And our core investing is true software. Enterprise infrastructure, enterprise applications, and consumer infrastructure are our core building blocks we fund. There are seven of us that do investments there. And one question that is asked me is, how do I become a venture capitalist? All the people that you see here have run software companies before, with the exception of the guy in the middle with the bigger head. That's John Hummer. John is 6'10". He is the tallest venture capitalist. I can say that I'm the shortest. Our average height is 6 feet. But John went to Princeton undergrad and was a first-round draft pick for the Seattle Supersonics and played NBA basketball for 7 years. He did decide that he should become more knowledgeable on software, so secretly he started taking programming classes at a community college and didn't tell any of us. He didn't ask what he should take, so when he graduated, after taking courses in assembler, we told him maybe he had picked the wrong language, but that was in 1990. So we view ourselves as coaches. We're no longer the players. We were all professional software players. We all built software companies. Mitchell Kurtzman built PowerSoft and ran Sybase. Doug Kickey ran MFS and Global Center. Mark Gorenberg was on the original Spark team and ran an EDA company after that. And I built the 16th largest PC software company. So we're coaches now. That's our job, is to help teams win, but we don't get to go out on the court with the ball anymore. So what we've done over the last 18 years is we've built 108 software companies. 17 of them have gone public, 34 IPOs, 12 were acquired or went public at more than 10 times the value of the investments. And we've had a really big year this year. We have a history of successful companies, and I'm just going to give you a couple examples here. Hyperion, a company that was just acquired by Oracle this last summer. We funded Hyperion when it was two people, Jim and Bob. Jim was a sales guy, and Bob worked for NASA, so he technically was a rocket scientist. He'd never written any commercial code. And Jim and Bob walked in and said, we want to build a company. They actually called it multi-dimensional systems, and we told them that we don't control what you name your company, but that might be a mouthful. And they renamed it Arbor in the beginning. They acquired another company called Hyperion and then renamed it Hyperion. But Jim and Bob alone started a company that built $3.3 billion of market cap over a seven-year period. And that's the typical story of all these companies. How many people have heard of Wind River Systems? Wind River is the leader still in embedded software, real-time and embedded software. Wind River had five people and a hot tub. When we went to visit them, it was quite interesting because the hot tub was over the entrance of the building, meaning you had to walk in under the naked programmers who were just kind of chilling out, or actually not chilling out in a hot tub. When we went to visit them the first time, there were 10 people. Eight were in the building, two were in the hot tub. And we walked in with General Motors, and we were just petrified that the General Motors guy who was going to purchase some software for them would actually look up and hear, try to figure out what that gurgling noise was above the entryway, but he never did. And Wind River was started by Jerry Fidler, out of Lawrence Livermore. If we go forward here, why are we focused on software companies? Because even today, it's really possible to build software companies with very little money. I built my software company with $500 and no venture capital. That was not by choice, that was by requirement, because in the early 80s, there was not a venture capitalist anywhere who would ever give any software company any money. But today, it's even more true for you. With open source tools, with cloud computing storage resources, for a few hundred dollars, as long as you don't need a salary, and you can afford to pay yourself to eat, you can start going. But you do need software to build. You do need dollars to reach scale. But these are still very capital efficient businesses. We are typically the lead investor, meaning we do the Series A investment. That's the highest risk point. That's where there's just a Jim and a Bob. That's where there's Jerry, the hot tub, and seven other guys. And sometimes we do these deals alone, but sometimes we bring another venture capitalist in with us. One thing we like to say is it's always better to have two investors at the beginning because you don't want to get a boss, you want to get a board. So just a few things about what's going on in venture capital before we talk about some of the disruptive trends and actually what we look for as a venture investor. It looks like things have gone badly here when you look at that 2000 peak and where we are today. But you should be very fortunate that you didn't start a company in 1999 or 2000. That's the boom-bust period. That's when everybody became a venture capitalist. Almost every corporation was an investor. Everybody who had money was an angel investor. And there were an abundance of venture capitalists. But we've been in a steady state since about 2002. That means about, you know, $22 to $25 billion invested in the U.S. each year in new companies and existing companies and follow-on rounds. And that steady state, it'll be slightly higher this year, but still pretty steady state. So it's a great time to raise money right now, and probably will stay this way over the next 3 to 5 years. What's happened during this period is some venture firms went away. There were some new venture firms created, but actually the ones that left the business far outweighed the ones that came in. The angel investment area has become much more formalized. It's not just a bunch of individuals that say, hey, can I find a company? Even here in Santa Barbara, it's a very formal syndicate of angel investors who really are willing to roll up their sleeves with smaller amounts of money than institutional venture capitalists like ourselves. The same is true in the Bay Area with groups like the Band of Angels or the Founders Fund that will put maybe $250,000 to $500,000 in a company versus just trying to get money from friends and relatives. If we look at what happened recently, there are a couple big new trends which are changing what people are investing in. We just got our third quarter data, and again, it was pretty steady state, a little bit of an increase in dollars, but a decrease in the number of companies. So when you look at this and you say 635 companies around the U.S. got a round of venture capital. These aren't 635 new companies. In fact, probably, you know, less than 20% of these are brand new companies. That's in the whole U.S. So it is a high bar to get venture funding. And it does mean that those that do get the bigger dollars do have a competitive advantage. Probably the most important thing to look at here is, again, as I've said, that the VC investment in software companies was the largest area. So if you're a computer scientist, a mathematician, an engineer that can write code, this is where still the majority of the money went, $2.2 billion of the dollars. But a new category has emerged. Until this last quarter, this was just called other because it was such a small amount of money. Anything that was in semiconductor, hardware, consumer, retailing, our software was just dumped in a very, very small bucket called other. But for the first time, there was increased interest in energy, advanced specialty materials, chemicals, and this includes anything that includes clean tech. So the core sciences are playing a bigger, bigger role in company formation. In fact, energy alone, which is a composite of these core scientific skills, was $590 million in 33 new companies in the third quarter alone. And this means this money didn't go somewhere else. It still software increased in dollars, so it didn't go into hardware, or it didn't go into semiconductor. So this is a brand new area. In fact, many of my colleagues have decided they're kind of bored with investing in software, semi, or hardware, and they've gone into phone booths, put on a cape, and came out energy supermen. We even have Al Gore doing energy investments in Silicon Valley now, so you never know, you'll probably see him on campus soon looking for new deals. But for all of you who are studying here, it is really key to understand that the possibility of you having entrepreneurial jobs in your fields, where not only will you be helping build products, but you will be shaping companies, is getting higher and higher. So that means that in addition to understanding the core sciences, which give you the entry fee, that those will be just, basically the table stakes. Your core scientific experience, your core science experience. You will have to bring to the table, how do I help build a company here as well? We also said that seed and first round were steady, but remember that there was $8 billion invested and only 1.7, which is about 20%, went to new companies. The rest is follow-on rounds. So if you take that 635 deals and take probably a little less than 20% in number, that's probably only 100 new companies, 33 of which were energy, in each quarter created. So when you see all these big numbers, you get a sense that there's an abundance of capital. Capital is not as abundant as you think, and that means that you need to think through, how do I get my company started as capital efficiently as possible? How do I use and leverage tools that are out there? Overall, in the software area, the IT was a large category, but we talked about software already being 27%. This is a slide that I like to show for software as itself. You know, we like disruption. We don't like it just plain old innovation. We like disruption. You know, innovation happens all the time. It is independent of economic cycles. It is, in fact, when I started my software company in 1976, the same year as Microsoft started, between 1975 and 1976, Microsoft got started, Apple got started. I started my company, a little company in California that my friend and colleague Karen worked for, Digital Research, got started. Unemployment was 11% in the state of Minnesota. There was inflation, gas lines. So this was all over the country. The president of the United States, that would be Nixon, resigned. I lived in Minnesota, and in 1976, the Vikings lost the Super Bowl, so nothing went wrong, right. So, you know, but that was, think of that year. Microsoft, Bill Gates drops out of Harvard to start Microsoft. Steve Jobs sells his Volkswagen to get Apple off the ground. In fact, Vint Cerf finished his DARPA grant at Stanford in 1976 to create TCP/IP, the cornerstone of the internet we know today. So you can't have any excuse for being an innovator. It is really independent of, you know, economics, you know, pestilence, war. You know, innovation continues along, but disruptive moments rarely occur. What's happened in the software marketplace is that over time, we'd wait for a platform to shift. So we all got started in the late 70s and early 80s because of the personal computer and the creation of operating systems there. In fact, it was, you know, Apple's operating system and DOS that let that happen. Things kind of purred along here, and you can see those flat lines. And one day somebody said, well, gee, how about kind of servers? And presto changeo, in about 1990, client-server computing happened. For us, it was magical. It was when we started our fund. We created, we funded 16 software companies in our first fund. You know, five of them went public. You know, nine of them got acquired. Only two of them didn't make money because we hit one of these disruptive points right on the head. Well, then we had the internet, and that changed things. And, you know, what do we wait for now? You know, what disrupts things? Well, suddenly nobody cares about the operating system. The operating system is no longer the disruptor. So what's driving software investments today? Software as a service. Probably heard about a few little companies like Salesforce. In fact, there was a little, one of our companies went public last year, Omniture, has a $2 billion market cap today. Actionable analytics. If your math is big now, you know, math students, math wizards, you know, are in short supply. You know, they'll pay you gazillions of dollars to come to Google and come to lots of other companies. Because suddenly, when all the data is on the network, you don't have to install something on a server and hope that the customer can use it. You can mainline right into that data and use really deep algorithms to make data actionable for the customer. We used to call this the data processing segment. You know, we don't process data anymore, we act on it. Open source, a huge disruptor in changing the pace of innovation, in changing how you work with the customer, in changing how you engage. I'm on the board of a company called MuleSource, and again, we don't name our companies, and they do have a jackass as their logo. It's a cute jackass, but you know, we funded them a year ago last September. Since they've had 1 million downloads, millions of dollars of revenue for an open source enterprise services bus. Who are their competitors? A few little companies like TIBCO, BEA, IBM. But you know what? Those products are old. They're expensive. They're not part of the collective innovation community that you see on MuleSource's Forge, where new tools and pieces are showing up for this product contributed by developers and the customers alike. Virtualization, another big, probably the biggest IPO of the year, and the queen of Silicon Valley is Diane Greene of VMware. You know, it really is only at the start. You know, right now, if I'm a software developer and I wanted to start a company, I can have a virtual Linux box in the Amazon cloud for literally $50 a month. You know, that's just that would be impossible. You know, this allows me to leverage my data center, which Amazon. The benefit is dual. Amazon, you know, uses the excess capacity in their data center in an elastic computing environment, and I get to use it as I need it as well. Data center architecture and optimization. When you put everything on the network, the data center takes center stage. It's not the server anymore or the PC. It is the data center. Well, whoever thought about optimizing the data center or its architecture? That's pretty much a wide open turf. Services-oriented architecture, which is how the software is changing the platform versus the operating system itself. Global distributed development and deployment, the development tools themselves. So these seven things were disruptors, guess what, 7 years ago. Now they're themes. So what's happened, what do the disruptors look like? Now we have these disruptors mashing up. What happens when you take open source plus open standards plus software as a service? Hey, how about integration in the cloud? There's that cute little mule with wings. You know, now these disruptors tend to show up. In fact, if I go back here, in 2005, Ray Ozzie's memo from Microsoft was leaked to the Wall Street Journal. And that memo said, software as a service is going to be disruptive. We made our first software as a service investment in 1998, 7 years before that memo. So these disruptions are well below the surface before you see the great companies. So below the surface now is the mashup of these disruptors. How are all these pieces coming together to even more shake up the incumbent software map? Actionable analytics plus SaaS. I'll use that little company that you've not heard of in the middle. Omniture is a big company now, thousands of customers, $2 billion market cap, Baynotes. This is a young guy, Jack Gia. He was the CTO of Interwoven, a boring client-server content management company that did well, went public. And he said, how do I use some of this Web 2.0 stuff in the enterprise? So he went to Stanford, looked for some behavioral psychologists, some algorithm guys, and said, have you ever searched, how many of you search on the UCSB site? How many people find what they're looking for? One person. You don't search very much. So what happens is there's probably a Google Enterprise search engine in there. And is that tuned to your large, massive portal that includes the alumni site, the this site, the that site? No. So when you do search, you pick around and find what you want. What Baynote does is it says, look, I'm going to use 20 different factors and figure out what the searchers actually do. It's not a recommendation engine. And over time, I'm going to really rerun the search results through the Baynote thing and leverage the wisdom of the searchers. They applied this to content and media sites. AMD had a big problem on their site where if they were looking for papers on heat dissipation, the first thing that would come up is who's bringing the hot chips to the company picnic. That was not very useful. But e-commerce sites, Google's not tuned to shoes or shovels or, tractors. So e-commerce sites, when they started relying on the wisdom of their shoppers, their sales went up in one case by 20%. And again, that's delivered as software as a service. Nothing's installed, just the data comes through the network, the search results after the searcher picks the results are sent through the Baynote search engine, and it sort of overlays search as time goes on. How about SaaS plus virtualization? You get the cloud. We recently funded a new company called Alastra. They have 11 beta sites now, where they have a database that's effectively sold as a dial tone. It's an infinitely scalable database, relational database in the cloud. Never installed anywhere. And this is a three-time entrepreneur. He recently started Plumtree. But this is only possible to be delivered as a service and virtualized and delivered in the cloud. And right now on Amazon's cloud. So these disruptions drive investments and they change industries. It's not good enough to just have there be technical changes to create innovation. But a lot of other things have to change. How software is developed. Today, most funded software companies are using Eclipse. They're using some form of agile software development, meaning they're probably doing 3 to 4 week sprints and not 2 year development processes. They are likely working on developing software with customers involved. If it's an open source project, they probably have contributors who are not employees of the company also helping build the software. What is a platform? There are no more platforms. Everything's a platform. If I'm building something for the CRM market, the Salesforce S-Force platform might be my platform, if I asked you. If I'm building something in the Amazon cloud, well, Alastra might be part of my platform. There's no such thing as a platform vendor anymore. There are platforms everywhere. And that has completely changed the power equation with traditional platform vendors, for example, Microsoft. How open is open? Good examples. In the last week, Verizon announced, hey, we're just going to open our whole, you know, infrastructure, you know, a cellular infrastructure. Apple said, well, not us. And Google said, well, we're going to be open too. In fact, we were the guys that drove open, but we're going to provide all the tools to be open on all this open stuff. So you really have to be incredibly open to be a new participant, unless you're Apple. Now remember, Apple is in the fashion business. The rest of the companies are in the technology business. So, you know, you have to be incredibly open. How does your product become a platform for someone? How software is priced, deployed, and maintained. We call the pricing models in software, usually most people are selling in what's called a perpetual licensing model. You go out there, put a price tag on your software, go to a customer and say it's $50,000. Get the $50,000, move on. That pricing model is almost dead. Today, most people are saying, hey, why don't you pay for my software as you use it? And how you use it might be different. In the case of Alastra, it's going to be priced on how much of the how much data you use. It's kind of a new database in the cloud pricing model. In the case of Amazon, it's by the use. In the case of Salesforce, it's per month, per user. So it's a subscription pricing model. You get less upfront, but you get recurring revenue over time. How it's deployed and maintained. Most people stay connected to their customer. Software as a service, you have one application that's running multiple tenants. That means that everybody's software is updated at the same time. The quality of software is improving. And also, there's none of this, oh gosh, I hope you'll upgrade to the next release. Who is a software vendor? Is Verizon a software vendor? Is Amazon a software vendor? How about British Telecom? They just bought Counterpane last year, and they provide security services as an MSP. Are they a software vendor? Lots of new entrants in the software market. So as you think of your company and who your partners will be, don't just think of the traditional software vendors. Think of the entire landscape, because software is the palette for innovation for any company in the world, and is more and more becoming part of the business model of those companies as well. The value of data. Again, we talked about actionable analytics, and there used to be absolutely no value in the data itself. You'd mine it and, you know, maybe get tell people what was in it. But data is becoming increasingly valuable. We go back just a minute to these guys, Omniture. Omniture does real-time business optimization for the web analytics for everybody from Microsoft to eBay to Home Depot to Sears to Neiman Marcus. And their chief marketing officers sit in front of a dashboard that tells them how their customers are behaving on their web-facing properties. It also allows them to even run multiple versions of their websites and compare the behavior. The value to those users is only data, and how the data is actually adds value to their company. Baynote the same way. Starmine ranks the analysts. Starmine is just in the process of being acquired by Reuters for about $100 million. And it's just algorithms of analyst performance. So think about, maybe the value is not in the infrastructure that you deliver or in the application, but what you can do with the data, because everybody has access to the data now. It is on the network. Overlaid on all this is, this is just fruit basket upset for security. You know, if you think security's done, it hasn't even started. You know, even all some of the simple things like data breaches, like PCI, you know, that's a huge problem. But how do you secure a virtualized environment? What does that mean? You know, what's a firewall in those situations? You know, what kind of havoc will hackers perform on the cloud? So, you know, there's going to be this security overlay on everything. So that is a continuing investment area. And there's really a lot of opportunities for breakthrough there, most of that coming from universities. So let's take a little segue here and talk about, let's say you actually can leverage one of those disruptors. You know, you really have latched on to a contemporary software build, software go-to-market, software maintain, software pricing model. What are we looking for when we invest as investors? I'm sure you hear this, but it's worth going through one more time. First, in software, it's the team. You know, we can't just invest in great products because it is the intellectual capital that drives the business. Almost every company is a little bit like this. They sort of start down this path and kind of wander around for a while. You hope they don't go like this, because there's a chance to really veer off the road that way. But the team really has to have, they have to be natural athletes with a deep understanding of what is the market need that they're trying to fulfill. When I mean customer and market understanding, I mean that you just didn't invent something. We see great inventions. We cannot fund inventions. We can only fund a tight fit to an unmet market opportunity. We like to say that Warren Buffett, who is the best investor in the universe, bar none, says one thing: the market bats last. And that means that great entrepreneurs, either when they build their prototypes or even before, have the courage and conviction of their invention to go talk to customers, even if they don't have anything to sell yet, before they talk to us. And you'd be surprised about that today. When I was running my software company and I would sell to large companies, I would have to go in the front door and go downstairs because everybody that was a technical person worked in the bottom part of the buildings and sometimes in the basement. And they were called management information systems people. That has completely changed today. Today, the people that our companies talk to are chief information officers, chief information architects, chief security officers, chief marketing officers. Because software is so strategic to companies, you're talking at the strategy level. All of those people who buy software are not rewarded for productivity, whatever. They're rewarded for moving their companies forward. They are innovators just like you. And when they see something that can move them forward, they become your best friend. And you only need a couple of them to have a best friend to really understand, is this a big enough problem? How do I shape it for the real market? How would I price the value of this product? Can I talk to the people that would be sitting at desks, at browsers, whatever, and using it? After you've got that licked, you found some friends in the marketplace who really are your core partners in innovation, we're going to try to see if there's some unfair competitive advantage. You know, certainly there are many that are not technical. They could be partnerships. But, you know, what really is the secret sauce here? What's the product breakthrough? And ultimately, because we're software investors, we're going to say that once we add up all the numbers, does this turn into software economics? And I'll give you a good example here. Software economics means that 80% gross margins and the opportunity to have 20% EBITDA. And if you don't know what gross margins are and you're trying to invent a product, you better figure that one out too, because every venture capitalist will ask you what kind of gross margins are you going to get on this product. And that's not taught in math class. It's in one of those easier classes called accounting. But the truth is a lot of people blow that. They say, gee, I'm just going to go out and build a few one-offs for my customer. Well, the great thing, how you get to 80% gross margins is that you build it once and sell it a gazillion times, because the cost of selling the second one is very low. But if you build it once for one customer and then once for another customer and then you build it three times again, you know, then you are not a software company. You are a professional services company. And guess what? Professional services companies have to bring people along with the product. And, you know, in order to make the customer your friend, you have to hang out with the friend much more than even your best friend you'd hang out with. They get 45% gross margins. And even if you don't know what gross margins are, 45% is worse than 80. So you really want to see, how can I make this a software business? You want to move away from customization as quickly as possible. That's the remnant part of this market. You know, in the ecosystem of software, there are very successful professional services companies, Accenture, you know, EDS, Perot Systems, you know, Bearing Point, you know, you can be those too, but that's not a software company. Those are professional services companies. So when you come to us, we want you to have 10 slides, and only 10. Here's what they are. You know, one is, you probably tease us by sending us an executive summary, one page. You know, what's the problem we're solving? What's our unfair advantage? When you get to your slides, that's our elevator pitch. What's my mission? Sometimes you'll find that you hook the venture capitalist on slide one. We've been looking for a company that could do this. We are going to pay rapt attention to you. Now, how do you know if it's a mission statement? First of all, cross out all the buzzwords, and if you have any words left, that would be your mission. Get in an elevator, press the button, and hit the third floor. If you can't state it between floors one and three, it's not a mission statement. It's your executive summary said fast. Second is, who are we? Remember, we're funding you. We will never fund a great idea without a great team. We'll never fund a bad idea with a great team either. But we're looking for both. You know, who are we? You know, you are who you are, you know, but you should have some element in your background that makes you the right fit for this opportunity. Market analysis. This slide says, slide one says, here's why we're here. Slide two says, here's who we are. Slide three says, it's big. This is not a niche market. Now, your go-to-market strategy, how you get started in market, might start small. But this says, if we capture the flag, is it one of those little tiny flags you carry around on the 4th of July, or is it one of those giant flags on a flagpole? It doesn't have to be big, but you should be able to distill your market opportunity down to a few bullet points. Then, why is this breakthrough? Why do we have a core competitive advantage? Why has this never been done before? You know, why build a company around this now is what that's saying. The next one says, you know, what are my key assumptions about this? That might include, you know, that I can, you know, that X customers will buy this now at X price, but what are your key assumptions? There's never more than five or six there. After that, who would be my customers? And in fact, at any point along the way, past your team slide, if you can bring the customer in the room, talking about your market. We've been working with Pfizer. Pfizer has 4,200 people who could use our product, and they're representative of one of the first 100 customers we can capture. When you talk like the customer, this is one where you say, we've talked to four customers. Let us tell you about how they would use the product. And that customer slide might be two or three. If you already have customers, we call it the trophy slide. It's the trophy shot. I've got X, Y, and Z. And those, you know, we're suckers for the trophy slides, because it means getting customers is hard. And the fact that you have any at the start is unbelievable. But you probably won't have any. But you'll have to have some that you've talked to. We have others we can call. Then what's my product plan? You know, how will this product roll out? That might include a technical slide, which is an engineering slide. And then, you know, how do I sell this stuff? How does this all work? You know, we think the value of this product will be this, that this is what customers are willing to pay. And here is how we're going to bring it to market. Are we going to hire salespeople? Are we going to get somebody to resell it? Are we going to just put up a website and sit there? Are we going to use, you know, SEO and get it optimized into Google? How are we going to tell people we're here and deliver the value proposition pitch to them? Or who is going to do that for us? And then at the end, you have to have a slide that says, gee, we've told you about the market opportunity, we've told you about the team, we've told you this is a big opportunity, we've told you this has an unfair, what our secret sauce is, we've given you some assumptions about, you know, why we think this is big, we've told you about customer validation, even customers we talked to pre-building it, we have a plan to build the product or to bring it to market. Now, is this a business? That's when you've got to build an operating plan. Now, people say, gee, you know, I've never built an operating plan. Then you won't get funded. You will not get funded unless you can quantify this as a business. Doesn't need to be perfectly right. We rip it apart and rebuild it for you if we fund you. But as we say, numbers aren't your strategy, but it tells us if you have a strategy worth funding. You have to be able to stand back from the opportunity, from the product, from everything else, and say, if I count up all the people I'm going to hire, the cost of bringing it to market, and I add in what people are going to pay for it over what period of time, does this look like a business that someone would fund? You should do that for yourself, because you're going to put a lot of time and energy in this. And it's amazing how many entrepreneurs come to us when they show us the business model. We say, you know, that doesn't really look big enough for us. You know, it's a good business if you want to do it. But usually the numbers get smaller versus bigger in most businesses. People say, gee, I should have spent more time on my operating model to really see if this is a business I want to do. You're right, it was a small opportunity. So, you know, if you're not good at doing this, this is where you find a person to help you with this. You have to be able to talk that slide, though. If you're the CEO of the company or the founder that's going to get this off the ground, that's not a slide where you bring in the rented accountant that you had used. You have to walk us through those numbers. So we're asking for an all-around athlete here. We're asking for someone who really has a great sense of a market opportunity, has validated it, has the ability to deliver a product against that opportunity, and can quantify the business opportunity. These are 10 hard slides to put together, but they're only 10. We get a lot of gobbledygook where people spend like 20 slides on the product. Great. We're not funding products, we're funding companies. It's very, very, very important to realize. And angel investors, since it's no longer just a la carte people doing that, remember I said angel environments have become much more formalized and professional, more like venture capitalists, they're going to want these same 10 slides because they want to fund businesses too. They just want to give you a little less money and, you know, to at an earlier point perhaps. And we have funded many companies with two people. Liquid Audio, a public company, two people. Hyperion, two people. Most of them didn't have the five guys in the hot tub. But all those two people had these 10 slides. They were business athletes, not just inventors. So with that, you know, we've got some great investments. Go to our website, check it out. We're going to turn this over to Q&A because it's getting kind of late, and I can see people writing down questions. So I guess there's some microphones. So let's have some questions or answers. Questions? There must the guy with the hat, you've got a question.
I was just wondering, in the balance between doing an open source and a proprietary piece of software, if your company wants to take advantage of what you can get from open source but not give away the whole deal, what's the best strategy for doing that?
Well, it's, you know, the question is, you know, should you be an open source company or not? There is no company today building software that doesn't have open source in their product. You know, you should make sure that if you're going to build commercial software that it's got the correct licensing in it, so you're not going to get walloped on that. But you're either open source or you're not. Being an open source company suggests, you know, a lot of different way of engagement, that you are going to let people download your product for free, and you are going to go back to them and sell a relationship with your customer versus selling the first relationship with your product. You know, you're going to open up your code to other developers. You're going to set up a forge. You're going to really be religious about your commercial open source stack. There really are fewer pure open source companies than what I'll call hybrids, where you've got open source in your code, but you're not doing any of these other things. You might have some pieces be downloaded, you know, so people can demo and test your software, but you're really not following the full open source model. If you do start an open source company, make sure that the law firm you work with is really, really knowledgeable about all the GPL licensing and the kind of agreements you have to set up to actually even license open source software to large enterprises. But the difference is quite dramatic in how you operate as a company. In the case of MuleSource, they were an open source company for 3 years, and they had about half a million downloads at the time we funded them a year ago. They've got 1 million now. And believe me, it's sort of like a running train. You know, then you say we're commercial, and all of a sudden customers call you up and say, oh yeah, we want to install you on all our servers, where's the contract? And you're in instant price negotiations, instant contracts, so you got to get your ducks in a row, and you do need to build an instant company around a commercial open source company if you've been in the open source environment for years before. But it's not for everybody, and it's not for every category. Sir, the gentleman up here.
I wanted to ask about the point that you touched on as far as staying away from customizability, so that otherwise you become a service provider's company, and it's a logistical nightmare. Then you also mentioned security and cloud computing and all the different interoperability problems that are arising. And all the streamlined solutions for security, they don't work. And that's why the security solutions people are paying for cost so much money, because there's all this new stuff coming out. A lot of it has to do with policy implementation. You have to get 13,000 employees all on the same page, so that way people aren't bringing laptops in and out of the building. You know, double-sided badges, a lot of physical type stuff. How do you streamline a solution when everything around you is chaos and is changing?
Well, it's not as chaotic as it seems. You know, clearly the security innovation or commercialization has lagged other software innovation, so that means there's opportunity there. But the most major corporations really have thought through the security overlay and have, next year alone, it is projected that the largest budgeting area will still be security. So you're right about that. But it's not like they have a chaotic approach. They are now synchronizing that with their other software deployments and innovations. So there's a lot to be done. That is true. But it's not as chaotic as you think. You know, the ability to, provision people with their security capability. Actually one of our companies, Bridgestream, was acquired by Oracle. That's what they do. And they made it so simple that the HR people could do it. You know, so that, you know, it was, you know, locked into role responsibility over at HR. So things are moving even up to the application stack there. We have a company called Voltage Security, which is software out of Stanford from about 3.5 years ago. And they use simple mathematics to replace the whole PKI infrastructure. So there's no certificates. And, you know, so they apply math on either your unique identifier for email, or, you know, rows and columns on databases for securing the data. So there are big leaps forward going on which lessen the overhead of deployment. Their typical customer is deployed in days. A 40,000 user customer is 2 days. So there is innovation, but you're right about some of the innovation requirements there. Deployment has to be simpler. Some of the old mechanisms for security are not going to be lugged along. Certificate infrastructure is one example. Authentication is fine as long as you know who you're supposed to be authenticating for one thing. So how do you move that up to a line of business versus that the CISO is doing that stuff? That is happening, but it does accentuate what it requires to be an innovator there is you really got to leapfrog the stuff that was, you know, oh, we could secure a perimeter. There was always a perimeter. Oh, great, there's no perimeter. So, you know, that's just opportunity. And there will be enormous spends on that over the next few years.
So I'm a big fan of two books, Tipping Point and Blink. And I'm wondering, so do you have blink moments when you meet an entrepreneur or an idea? What are the cues that come to you quickly? And then the second is for someone who has not started a previous company or you haven't funded previously, could you explain a little bit about the dance of bringing a VC to a tipping point of deciding that they want to join on the deal?
Well, my favorite books are, I do like Tipping Point, I don't like Blink, but I do like Michael Porter's Competitive Advantage, and I think at some universities they still actually use it, which says you have to break down your business into assumptions. That's the essence of that book. And if you know what your key assumptions are and you just look at those, you will always have a competitive advantage. It's a textbook, so you know, read it now when you're still in the mood for reading textbooks. But all we have in the beginning of these companies are assumptions. We have very few facts. You know, we have some validation points, but they're not yet facts. When my company was acquired, I was acquired by a very large company. And, you know, nobody ever gave me any management training. And so I go to the first board meeting and, you know, I've got this big PowerPoint ready of how great my division is doing. And the CEO of this company, who is a GE executive formerly, and they live and die by Michael Porter, said, well, all I want to know is, are your assumptions still valid? And I said, what assumptions? And they go, the assumptions you're using to operate this business, there must be less than 10 of them. And I'm saying, and so, you know, I'm rapidly waiting for my turn because it's, you know, to write down 10 assumptions. And he goes, are they still valid? I said, yes. And he goes, great, you're fine then. Because if one of those assumptions breaks, is wrong, your business has to be changed. We talk about being hooked in 5 or 15 minutes, which you call a tipping point. But we have the advantage as a early stage venture firm of seeing tons of entrepreneurs. So we get to be good at pattern matching. Hey, that almost sounds like a good idea. And so we tend to develop, it feels like, but we're only kidding ourselves, a sixth sense of the missing pieces, but the puzzle pieces keep showing up, and suddenly somebody's got all of them. And we keep talking to customers along the way as well ourselves. So how do you hook a venture capitalist? How do you get to them? Early stage venture capitalists, true early stage venture capitalists, will read their emails. You just email us. Later stage venture capitalists, you know, good luck sending them an email. You know, your previous funders, if you have an angel investor, that's one of their roles, is to help introduce you to venture capitalists. You can't start a company without a good lawyer. You know, when you go interview your law firm you're going to work with, say you work with early stage companies and charge us very little money, and how many VCs do you know? They don't know any, they're the wrong lawyer. Talk to your accountant. You know, if you're going to do our accounting for us, you know, are you willing to work with a startup and not charge us much money? How many venture capitalists do you know? None? Wrong accountant. You build an ecosystem at the beginning of people who know the people you need to know. Same with your lawyer. Hey, we're going to be selling in the pharmaceutical industry. How many pharmaceutical companies can you open doors for us? None? How many VCs? None. You're certainly not our lawyer. You know, really, you've got to find these, you know, I don't see tipping points so much as I really see that you have to get yourself on the market map. And as an early stage company, market map means I got to get close to funding sources. I have to get close to customers. And I have to develop unfair competitive advantages for myself. I'm going to walk through those doors, but I don't know how to open them all. That's our job, to open some of them. That's a job of everybody you associate with your company, is either they're going to be walking through the doors with you or they're door openers. Otherwise, they don't have a role. The tipping point, you know, Malcolm Gladwell is a great author, and I think it was a little cheaty that he had a second great book, and it wasn't as deep as, the Blink was not as deep as the tipping point. But the tipping point means that you basically have yourself set up for these points. they don't automatically happen. You tip into funding because you were already aligned with, you know, half the people. Joe Gatto. I'll tell you the story of Joe Gatto, whose company is getting acquired for $100 million. We did a one-day event at the Software Development Forum in San Jose, California, three of us. It's kind of like a kissing booth. We'll sit there, and anybody can walk up to the booth, and we'll love your idea. And we do this once a quarter because sometimes we feel that our biases show up too much. So we just do free-for-all days. You know, my partner John calls it kind of the gong show because, you know, oh my God, this is going to be interesting. But we love it. One side story there, one guy did show up and heard that John called it the gong show, and he brought this thing that had a gong, and he gave it to John, and John goes, well, thank you very much. And John took it back to the office, and we don't know where that thing went. And about 3 months later, this guy called, and he said, could I have my gong back?
Yeah.
And John goes, where is that thing? And nobody knew. And he goes, it belonged to my great-grandmother. So, you know, if anybody gives you a gong, give it back to them. But Joe Gatto walked in. We'd never heard of Joe before. Joe didn't have a lawyer. Joe didn't have an accountant. Joe didn't have a friend who knew a venture capitalist. But he heard venture capitalists were going to be there. And it was a nonprofit does this. He had to pay $25 to the nonprofit. And he walked in. And we knew in minutes that this was a fundable guy, that we wanted to learn more about his business. We funded Joe. Joe subsequently raised about $15 million more. And Joe will, you know, in the next quarter be more than a multimillionaire. But Joe found a point of entry. He created his own tipping point. There's really, you know, with the internet, with websites, with everybody's email being obvious, you know, think of 10 years ago, if you were trying to find a venture capitalist, it was like a needle in a haystack. Now you know where every needle is. So, you know, just call. If people don't answer your email, it means they're, you know, in one day, don't panic. It does take about a week or 10 days for us to get through thousands of emails, but we will get back to you. And early stage venture capitalists try to give you some feedback as well. If you've never pitched a venture capitalist and there are venture firms local or angel funds, call somebody up and say, look, I think I'm going to start a business. Could I buy you a cup of coffee? Just a half an hour of your time. Like to talk about my idea, just get a sense, socialize funding before you fund. Only pick two or three people to do it with and see what kind of feedback you might get from the market by asking for a half an hour and, you know, a cup of coffee. And my guess is that potential funder will probably pay for the cup of coffee. So it's a lot easier than it looks. And, you know, we've all been entrepreneurs before, so we were in your shoes. We were once intimidated by the people that had the money as well.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.